Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case today is case number 53565, Development Corporation versus Summers. Mr. Harper for the appellants, Mr. Coffin for the respondent.
Morning, Your Honors.
How are you?
Doing great. Prabhat Vice Counsel, Mr. Yellick, will be doing the argument this morning.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And there's no reply brief in this matter, so you'll just have the 15 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Yollick, Y-O-L-L-I-C-K, and I'm here representing...
Could you spell that again, please?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. Y-O-L-L-I-C-K.
Thank you, Mr. Yollick.
And I represent Nutraceutical Development Corporation, Diane DiTavio, Melissa Rogers, and the estate of Dwight Cantrell, who are the appellants in this case, involving a claim by respondents David Summers and James Davidson, who claimed that they owned several million shares of Nutraceutical Development stock and that a share certificate giving all of the shares to a corporate parent named Endovasc, Inc. was forged. There was no evidence at trial, and if you look in the record, you will see there is not a specific allegation of who actually did the alleged forgery. In fact, there was evidence that the respondent, David Summers, acknowledged that he had signed corporate documents to agree to give all of the shares of Nutraceutical Development Corporation to Endovasc. Mr. Summers and Mr. Davidson brought derivative claims on behalf of NDC. At the same time in this lawsuit, they sued NDC, even though Mr. Summers claimed that he was the sole officer and director of NDC at the time. They did not bring claims on behalf of NDC. Instead, they brought direct claims as shareholders against the officers or the former officers of the corporation. There are five issues, if time permitting, that I would like to address with the Supreme Court this morning. First of all, there was a failure to join at least one, if not two, indispensable parties, which I believe was fatal to the trial court's judgment.
But did you ever raise that in district court in any type of motion?
Justice Givens, it was not raised in a motion. And if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in the Schwab versus Homseth case at 646 P. 2nd, 1212, in that case, the Supreme Court held that the failure to join an indispensable party is fatal and that it could be raised on appeal for the first time.
Right. No, I understand that you can't. Okay. I just wanted to know if you brought it up there.
No. Now, there was in the trial court a pleading in the answer that there was a failure to state a claim and that there also was a failure of standing.
But there was no reference to Rule 19 or Rule
answer
as an affirmative defense, though.
There absolutely was not.
Okay.
Now, the problem in this case is, and in fact, counsel for respondents handed to me an order from a bankruptcy court that actually was issued this morning related to Endovasc, Inc. And that illustrates that really Endovasc should have been joined as a party. The case could have been litigated in bankruptcy court. And now, in fact, the parties are being subjected to conflicting decisions where the bankruptcy court is relying on this trial court's opinion as res judicata and claim preclusive. When in fact there was a failure to join the proper parties in this case.
But if that were done, they would have had to file an adversary complaint in bankruptcy court and join all these non-bankrupt entities in that case. And is that a good policy just because one entity of many is in bankruptcy that the case has to be tried in bankruptcy court? Our federal judge colleagues seem to like to remand those cases. You know, they don't like to deal with them. But what's your thoughts on that?
Well, and Justice Givens, I think that the appropriate method would have perhaps been to join Endovasc in the trial, in the state trial court. And then if it had been removed to the bankruptcy court to remand it, because it was an issue of state law and it was at least a discretionary abstention, if not a mandatory one. But the problem here is that very similar to the Schwab case, which involved a ownership of a furniture company and a corporation that was the title owner of that furniture company, and its property interest in the shares were directly affected by the trial court's decision in the Schwab case in 1982. Similarly, Endovasc was not joined in this case, and Endovasc or George Gordon's share interest, whichever one it was directly affected by the ruling of the trial court that 27 million of the 75 million shares that had been issued were not owned by Endovasc, but in fact were owned by James Davidson, David Summers, and others. And so this case is very similar to the Schwab case, and I believe that you can't, under Rule 12H, there are certain defenses that can be waived and certain defenses that cannot be waived. If you look at the home furniture case that's cited by the respondents in their answering brief, the home furniture case clearly involves affirmative defenses, that those can be waived if they are not pled. However, both Rule 19 and Rule 12H, and really if you look at the distinction between 12H1 and 12H2, the failure to join parties under Rule 19 cannot be waived as a matter of law. And that's a very similar issue to the second point, and that is that there was a failure to comply with the heightened verification and demand pleading requirements to bring a derivative claim under Rule 23.1.
But they did plead demand futility in the verified complaint, didn't they?
I don't believe they pled demand futility. They did verify the complaint, however, is okay. My recollection. Okay. And the problem is that in this instance where there was at least contention by people aligned with the appellants in this case, that George Gordon, rather than these former officers and directors, is now in control of Nutraceutical Development Corporation, there is a chance that if they had properly pled and made a demand upon George Gordon, that he may have the claims on behalf of Nutraceutical Development Corporation.
Who were the directors of Nutraceutical at the time of the litigation was commenced?
It seems, and I say that as... It seems as though the director either was Diane DiTavio or it was George Gordon. George Gordon claimed that he was the director and that he had elected his son, Greg Gordon, James Gregory Gordon, to be the sole director of the corporation. The reason I say it seems is because that was actually one of the points.
And how many shareholders were there at the time the complaint was filed of Nutraceutical?
There either was one, which was Endovasc Inc., or there were about seven or eight shareholders.
The reason I ask, I think, don't you have to have, if there's more than one shareholder, you can't have just one director. Nevada law, is that correct? Or?
Justice Givens, I think you're correct. And actually, there may have been another shareholder, and I don't remember his name.
Okay.
Now, the other point that I wanted to make, though, under Rule 23.1 is that Mr. Summers and Mr. Davidson, because they were not only bringing a derivative claim, but actually were bringing a direct claim against the corporation as well as against some of the officers and directors, there is no way that they could have even been adequately representative of other shareholders because they were suing the corporation at the time. And so they could not have even met the heightened pleading requirement had they tried to plead properly under Rule 23.1. The third point that I'd like to make is that as to the fraud, breach of fiduciary, and actual damages claims, and actually really that's the third through fifth points, there just simply was no evidence in the trial court.
What's the burden of proof on breach of fiduciary duty?
In a breach of fiduciary duty, the burden of proof is, because this is not a failure to disclose case, this is a just straight up breach of fiduciary duty for improperly expending resources of the corporation. The burden of proof was, in fact, on the plaintiff in this case.
By what standard, though? What
burden of proof? It's a heightened standard by clear and convincing evidence.
Okay. I noticed nobody at either side cited the case of Bedore versus Familian, which is 122 Nevada 5, a 2006 opinion from the Supreme Court, which I think does discuss burden of proof and breach of fiduciary duty on directors, and it does talk about excessive salary claims and all that.
Right.
Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not familiar with that case, but I certainly am familiar with the context that you're talking about, Justice Givens, because one of the problems in this case was that this is exactly the type of second-guessing that this court has recognized and that the Nevada legislature has recognized that should not occur under the business judgment rule. And in fact, you know, there's this claim that this share certificate number 2 was forged. I'm very carefully using the passive voice in that sentence. It was forged. There was absolutely no evidence at trial as to who forged it. There certainly are cases that say you can have a fraudulent forgery of a document. However, in this instance, number one, we don't even know who the forger was. Number two, we don't know there certainly was no evidence that there was reliance by either of the plaintiffs on that forgery, and in fact, they disavowed reliance in their testimony and stated they knew that it was not a real, or at least they believed it was not a real document. In fact, the plaintiff's contention at trial was that it was Diane DiTavio, the defendant, who was relying upon share certificate number 2. And so they do not meet the reliance element to show by clear and convincing evidence that there was fraud, nor do they even show that there was a misrepresentation that was made that would constitute fraud. Now, with respect to breach of fiduciary duty, as you mentioned, Justice Givens, there is no question that there were expenditures by this corporation in 2005, that those expenditures involved some professional salaries. They also involve some out-of-pocket professional expenses, for example, to attorneys and to accountants, and there also were development costs. But there was no testimony that those expenditures were for some reason unreasonable or not completely consistent with the business of the corporation. Instead, there was almost an a priori decision at the trial court level that because these expenditures were made, they just shouldn't have occurred, they seemed too high, and because the net income of the corporation, the gross revenue was in the range of $500,000, that $400,000 of expenses was inappropriate. Well, this gets to really my last point, and that is the evidence with respect to damages. Because what the trial court did was, the trial court said that the damages against the individual defendants, or the individual appellants in this case, were based on NDC's net income. That basically, as I said, they compared the expenses to the net income. Well, the problem in this case, though, is that these are shareholders who are bringing those claims. And number one, there was no evidence that the corporation ever even issued a dividend. There was no evidence that the corporation ever would issue a dividend. As this court noted in its Southdown opinion at 51p second 640, there is a big difference between a shareholder's share value and the right to dividends. That first of all, you have to show that there would be dividends, which never occurred at the trial in this case. And second of all, you have to show that there actually is a loss in share value, of which there certainly was no evidence adduced at trial. In fact, what's interesting in the facts that developed in the record in this case is that Mr. Summers claimed that he was the sole director and officer, and he was making filings with the Nevada Secretary of State to that effect. But even Mr. Summers never came forward with any sort of corporate resolution, either by the board or the shareholders, and it would have obviously needed to have been the board, where he voted to issue dividends in his role supposedly as the, as he was claiming, as the sole director of the corporation. Therefore, for the trial court to say, okay, I don't like these expenses, they were unreasonable, and therefore the shareholders lost X number of dollars, there were about at least two levels of leaps that this court clearly did not recognize and does not recognize under Nevada law with respect to how damages are developed. Now, I haven't mentioned some of the other points that were raised in our opening brief. However, the punitive damages claim and the attorney's fees really both spring from the fact that, number one, there were no actual damages.
Well, let me ask you this. The attorney's fees were awarded under the bad faith provision of 18010. The punitive damages, the judge didn't have a separate hearing for punitive damages. Did that prejudice your client in any way? Yes, tell me how.
And that is one of the – well, because one of the problems is that by not having that hearing – Ms. DiTavio did not have the opportunity to bring before the trial court the fact that she had absolutely no idea whether or not share certificate number two was or was not a forgery, that there was no opportunity in a punitive damages hearing to present argument or evidence that no one knew who actually did the alleged forgery.
Was there financial information presented to the court, on the net worth of the defendants that they were seeking punitive damages against?
There was not.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Yowie.
Thank you.
Mr. Coffin, on behalf of respondents.
Good morning. Marquis Arbaugh Coffin, Terry Coffin, and Candace Renke on behalf of the respondents here. I must give suitable deference to my colleague from out of state for not being present at this trial, and I urge the court to, if the court has questions about what actually happened, but what we're here, as Judge Gonzalez said, was a tortured proceeding. It was a proceeding in which you have to suspend belief of the documents that they want to put before you because we have two entirely diametrically opposed sets of documents. We have one 75 million share certificate, and then we have a multitude of share certificates that were properly filed with a resident agent with NATCO here in the state of Nevada that outlined all the share certificate holders and their records. It includes Cantrell, DiTavio, Melissa Rogers. The court found, through clear and convincing evidence, that it was indeed the NATCO documents that we were advocating that were the true and correct documents, and that this share certificate they want to put forward, the 75 million share certificate, was indeed a forgery.
Do we know who did a forgery?
Well, the court, on page 6 of the decision, the court finds by clear and convincing evidence that defendant DiTavio and ostensible representatives of NDC knowingly and falsely created the 2002 certificate for the purpose of depriving the plaintiff and the other NDC shareholders of the benefit of their stock. We have that finding, and that was clear at the time. Dr. Summers testified that he did not execute that certificate. And with that unrebutted testimony, they tried to bring in this expert after the fact. That's what was before this judge. And recall.
So what evidence supports the court's finding number 12 on page 6 of its order?
That the finding that they acted intentionally and in concert to accomplish the unlawful objective of harming the plaintiffs? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, by creating the 2002 certificate. Is there any direct proof of that, or are you saying it follows as an inference from the gentleman's testimony you just mentioned?
I believe that there is direct proof of that in the sense that remember the scenario here, we have NDC and Endovast. The officers and directors are the same until they kick out Summers. The only asset is this stream of revenues coming from Western Holdings. And with Summers there, they take him out of the game, they control those significant stream of royalties. So it stands to reason now we have DiTavio, who testified at the trial, that she had a certificate with 880,000 shares. And what did she do with that? Well, she knew that those shares had been issued. They had to come up with a way to divest Dr. Summers of his interest in order to kick him out. And that's exactly what happened here, and I think that's exactly what Judge Gonzalez was seeing. As to the arguments regarding indispensable parties, it is truly difficult to stand here and say that Mr. Gordon, counsel for these two entities, was an indispensable party when he was disclosed 5 days before trial. 5 days. This is after he sat through the depositions down in Texas of his clients, purportedly at that time with either 75 million share interest or 48 million share interest, and said not one word. He participated in these proceedings, guiding the corporation behind the scenes, not one word. Hey, my interests are going to be affected. I need to pop up and protect them. Similarly, with Endovask, we have the same people in control. Did ever once Ms. DiTavio or anyone from the appellants stand up and say, whoa, 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 we've got to bring Endovask in here? No, never once. So while they want to chastise us for not bringing in what they call to be indispensable parties, despite the fact that I think our pleadings show that they've made those parties are truly not indispensable, they did nothing to protect their rights. They sat silent, and I think, as Justice Gibbons noted, they sat silent on most of the claims that they want to raise to you today on appeal, and they should not be allowed to do so.
Let me ask you about the derivative suit complaint. Did you plead demand futility in the derivative in the complaint?
Your Honor, did I specifically make a state use those words? I did not, but I think it is apparent from the facts that we have the same people. We have the Diane DiTavio saying, Summers, you can't vote your shares because we don't recognize them. Is Summers and Davidson at that point supposed to go back to them and say, well, wait, you know, can you make sure that you fix this for us? Of course not. Futility was obvious in this case from the outset because the command and control of Endovask and NDC were the same people, and it's the same people that kicked Summers out of the company that the district court found to be unlawful.
Can I jump ahead to the punitive damage phase, Mr. Coffin? Why did the parties stipulate to just consolidate that, or why wasn't there a separate proceeding held on punitive damages?
I concede that there was no separate hearing at that point, and I suggest to you that the issue of punitive damage was tried by consent. It was pled in our complaint. And Judge Gonzalez's procedure in the district court is that both parties are to submit proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, that are exchanged beforehand with each party so that the judge may have, in essence, competing findings of fact. They chose not to, for whatever reason, to present their own. We did, clearly outlining what we believed to be, you know, conduct that warranted punitive damages, and the judge awarded the same.
So you're saying they didn't ask for a separate hearing?
Correct. And again, an issue that was not raised below, but was clearly tried by consent. In the event that this court finds, and I do recognize the punitive damages are troubling, in the event that the punitive damages are an issue for this court's concern of a magnitude that would warrant reversal, I would offer that they be stricken rather than remanded. Because practical issues, the award of punitive damage may not be relevant at this point. The thrust of the trial below was always Summers was removed from control. These other Summers, Davidson, and the other, I believe, 18 shareholders were deprived of their interest by virtue of a forged stock certificate that they wanted to present to the court that really had no basis in law and fact. It's interesting that my client raises the issues related to the Endovask bankruptcy and your questions, Justice Gibbons, because this morning that issue was raised. And as a background, I want you to understand what has happened since the district court's order.
You're asking us to take judicial notice of what's going on in the bankruptcy?
I would, and I'd like to present the order that was issued this morning.
Any problem?
Subject to reservation of striking it. No, we haven't seen it. It's fairly irregular at this point.
Is it appropriate for me to speak?
Please do.
I am a little uncomfortable with it simply because I haven't even had, I mean, honestly, I've had 30 seconds to look at it. I don't even know what's in it.
Well, let me not have it. Let's not proceed with that. Let's just go with what we have, what we've anticipated in the conference and the briefs.
My purpose in raising it is that it is the arguments now, it relates to their arguments about Endovask and their rights. But remember, at the time we went to trial, Endovask was in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. To suggest that they needed to be joined was irrelevant.
They were in a Chapter 7?
They were in a Chapter 7.
Not an 11.
Not an 11. A trustee had been appointed. And you recall in the record that we proffered to this court that at the time they filed the bankruptcy, Endovask disavowed any ownership of NDC shares. To suggest now that they were somehow indispensable when they disavowed, and that's Ms. DiTavio signing those schedules, is again disingenuous. They had no rights at the time this matter went to trial, And if they had those rights, they should have raised them below. As for the issue of damages, it was the appellant's figures that Judge Gonzalez was referring to in their exhibit number 39. So, and obviously Judge Gonzalez is the thrust of her decision here is, since there was no authority for DiTavio and the NDC members to act at all, any such expenditures would have been excessive. And that's in light of the fact that Diane DiTavio testified at trial that NDC didn't do anything. All they did was maintain a patent and collect royalties. She testified very clearly to that. So that was an adequate basis for Judge Gonzalez to issue the award of damages. As to the attorney's fees, I think you can read the obvious umbrage that Judge Gonzalez had in awarding attorney's fees as a sanction for what she called a tortured proceeding. And recall, I direct the court to the testimony of Diane DiTavio, which was completely inconsistent, riddled with factual inconsistencies, and I dare say perjury. We presented the evidence that showed if she was that ignorant as to what was going on, then she was criminally ignorant. And certainly that forms a basis for Judge Gonzalez.
Now, was she a director of the corporation?
She was the president and one of two directors at the time of trial. There were, at one point, three directors, and I think right before trial, one resigned. But remember, we're directors of a corporation that has really no physical location. She's testified she ran it out of her home. Had no business, ongoing business, other than getting a check. That was it. So I think certainly the award of attorney's fees on that basis was not only reasonable, but I dare say necessitated. So, Your Honor, I would like to... And I'm glad we didn't have to go through all nine issues, but I believe that we have briefed this adequately. Further questions by the court I've entertained, but I really have nothing beyond the pleadings other than what I've stated today.
Justice Pickering, anything else?
No,
Justice
Gibbons?
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coffin, Mr. Yalek, for your arguments, briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.